This is Suno India Production. You can now listen to all our episodes on our Android and iPhone app. Download it now.
Indigenous people play an important role in protecting the environment. The tribals, or Adivasis as they are called in India, depend on the forest for survival. They have developed sustainable practices that preserve natural resources. Indigenous people are also increasingly being recognized as key partners in conservation efforts and are being included in decision-making process related to natural resource management. But contrarily in India, many tribals are still being jailed and are being harassed. Says the report, Wildlife Policing, the Reign of Criminalization in the Forest of Madhya Pradesh by Criminal Justice and Police Accountability Project. Hi, I'm Rakesh Kamal, host of this podcast, and I spoke with Mrinalini Ravindranath and Nikita Sovane, who are two of the 13 authors of this report. In this episode, I bring to you a very interesting conversation I had with them. Hello, thank you for coming on to this podcast today, Nikita and Mrinalini. Can you please introduce yourself and talk a little bit about your work in Criminal Justice and Police Accountability Project, please?
Hi, my name is Nikita Sovane and I'm the co-founder of the Criminal Justice and Police Accountability Project, and we're a group of lawyers and legal researchers based out of Bhopal in Madhya Pradesh. And the CPA project is a research and litigation-led initiative, which is primarily focusing on policing, and particularly the casteist nature of policing in India. Our work looks at studying police data and sort of analyzing the patterns that are emerging from this data under various criminal laws, seeing who are the communities that are routinely criminalized for what kinds of offenses and the processes by which this criminalization also takes place. And the research that we do is something that then fuels the litigation and advocacy efforts that we undertake. And we're driven by, I think, this sort of understanding and work, particularly with the denotified tribes, who are a community of people, nomadic and semi-nomadic tribes, who were categorized as criminals by birth through this colonial law known as the Criminal Tribes Act, and just seeing how the legacy of this law, which has now been repealed, continues to manifest itself within the post-independence criminal justice system and is upheld by policing, which is also in so many ways upholding certain casteist colonial ways of being and criminalization, and sort of entrenching that in everyday forms of policing. Yeah, so that's the sort of work that we are trying to do. And I think the conversation also that we are having today is sort of an extension of or reflecting on some of these questions within the framework of wildlife policing in India.
Hi, I'm Mrinalini Ravindranath, and I'm the research head at the Criminal Justice and Police Accountability Project. As the research head, alongside Nikita and the litigation head, Sanjana, we undertake and design research in the line of what Nikita has suggested, uncovering patterns not just of what happens at the judicial process in the criminal justice system, but fundamentally about the question of policing, as Nikita said, because these patterns have also existed in the shadows for quite long, and what they might tell us about the criminal justice system and more about the institution of policing is what we seek to uncover through every law that we study. As Nikita also pointed out, our litigation and research fuel each other. So the areas of research that we identify are very much from are decided on the basis of the cases that we undertake, which are so normally for petty offenses and normally are in the nature of criminalizing livelihoods and cultures of the various communities that we work with. And one of those pieces of research, like as Nikita mentioned, the wildlife policing research is what we're here to talk about today.
Great. I read your report on wildlife policing. The link to the report will be in the description of the podcast for whoever wants to read it in detail. But can you maybe explain briefly about the report a little?
Sure. So we came to this research because we'd known for a while that there were prosecutions that happened under the Wildlife Protection Act, not simply for the purposes that were violating the idea of wildlife conservation that exists, but fundamentally also of how communities have existed and what cultures and livelihoods they've depended on. So to this end, we began looking at police data, which looks at the number of arrests that the police have made under the Wildlife Protection Act and as well as the FIRs that they've registered, to uncover what kind of language they use, what is the form of criminalization that exists. And we additionally also looked at Forest Department data, which I think has not been looked at before this study. And we were able to uncover about 1,400 plus records of the kind of charges that the Forest Department frames in preparing a case under the Wildlife Protection Act. The story we also sought to uncover was, of course, one, what prosecution and policing under the Wildlife Protection Act looks like, but also what are the ways in which different communities are affected by this. So to this end, we specifically looked at forest-dwelling communities in the national parks and protected areas in Madhya Pradesh. Madhya Pradesh is known for having the highest number of protected areas in the country, and the amount of resources that are allocated in wildlife conservation are quite high. So the picture that Madhya Pradesh can tell us that's really important for the national platform as a whole is to be able to draw one, what example that Madhya Pradesh is setting for the rest of the country, and also to say that when most resources are going into wildlife conservation, what does then prosecution look like? So coming a little bit to the findings of the research, what we found were, of course, that the idea of wildlife conservation that is touted to be this inviolate fortress area that we need to create for the purpose of conservation is one, of course, that is completely against the picture that forest-dwelling communities who have existed in consonance with the forests have viewed conservation as. They see themselves very much as an part of the ecosystem of the forest. And this Brahminical kind of idea that's come in about wildlife conservation is that there needs to be a pristine forest where even communities who have existed in consonance with the forest have to be alienated so that the animals can be protected. So when we see lots of investments being made into projects such as Project Tiger, Project Elephant, and to save these things, and when these inviolate areas are created, we see that very, very routine, everyday activities of such communities come to be criminalized.
I read the report, and it's very interesting in terms of the data that you presented about how wild boars constitute the majority of hunting that happens, or the cases that are filed on people because of wild boar hunting. Can you please explain why people are being arrested for fishing in these areas?
Let me start with the wild boar question, right? So of course, as you mentioned that, you rightly pointed out that a lot of people are being charged for wild boar hunting. And I think it's very interesting how the wild boar, and there have been, particularly since 2016, there have been conversations for saying that the wild boar is something that should be treated as vermin under the law, right? So saying that not criminalizing the hunting of wild boar, but that hasn't come through. And now what we're seeing is that not only, of course, are people being charged for allegedly hunting wild boars, but we're seeing that in these areas, the population of the wild boar has also exponentially increased. So it's when we were doing field work, we came across a lot of cases where people said people were being charged for hunting a wild boar, and a lot of these were cases where people had actually put up barbed wires outside or done fencing around their land to protect the wild boars from destroying their crops. So we're seeing like this sort of menace that has been created by, the criminalization of the hunting of this animal, that not only is it a threat to, crops, it's also a threat to now people's lives. Because, we also spoke to several members of the Forest Department who said that they had been attacked by wild boars when they were doing their regular patrolling in various parts of the forest. So okay, we're seeing that there is this entire menace that has come about as a result of the criminalization of this animal. And not only is it affecting people's life, but also, you know, access to their livelihoods. And each time that people's crops are destroyed as a result of wild boar attacks, you are seeing that not only is it extremely difficult and close to practically impossible for them to secure compensation for crop loss, but you're also seeing that being used then as the basis for charging people for hunting. So it is, you know, it is this one, it's one of those situations where people are caught between the devil and the deep sea in this sort of web of criminalization and trying to either protect themselves or protect their crops from wild boar attack or, you know, allowing that for that to happen and then risking losing their livelihood and their crops if they want to protect themselves for not being charged for hunting for that reason. So it's this, you know, threat between constantly being charged for hunting and trying to protect one's livelihood that, and this is this sort of sticky situation that people are constantly finding themselves trapped in.
I'm a little confused still. Is hunting wild boar illegal or is it not? I mean,
It is.
Okay. But then the government decides...
It is an offense. Even though there have been pushes to say that it should not be.
Hmm.
It is an offense, which is what has led to this menace. Yeah, Mrinalini, come in.
I just want to add in here also that this is not some... I mean, of course, what Nikita is saying about the criminalization, that is the bulk of criminalization that we're seeing from the records that we've accessed. It's not like the most protected like species of animals like the tiger that's being hunted or prosecuted, or those are the ones that are being prosecuted. But these things where there are actually, I mean, one might even say accidental killings, or where it's actually in self-defense, that gets called a criminal offense. And then that prosecution that's triggered, it lasts for many years. It involves a disruption of like daily lives. Of course, it causes problems to the dependents on the crops that have also been damaged, that are rarely compensated. And there are, of course, administrative problems that also come in here, where while the Forest Department administrates like what the offenses over that land, since the land is ultimately called is under the Revenue Department, then the compensation form has to go in there. So if you're hurt by a wild boar, you might get compensated by the Forest Department. But if your crop is hurt, then it automatically goes to another department. So that's one bureaucratic mess that's there, which is, of course, hindering people from accessing compensation. And while this is a seasonal, yearly thing, the compensation is very few and like far in between kind of a situation. But this is also not a problem that's limited to Madhya Pradesh alone. As early as like 2003, and I think we've written about this before, there were attempts made by the government to say that maybe we should allow for culling of wild boars by basically specifying it as vermin species for a little bit of time. Even in the parliament recently, when the Wildlife Protection Amendment Bill was being discussed, this problem was highlighted. And this problem has been highlighted in at least six other states, in Kerala and Telangana and Rajasthan, Bihar, where they've all tried to make some inroads into how we think about this as a vermin species. But we think that the attendant criminalization that's happening is very, very much missing from when we discuss this issue, and a really, really big kind of consequence that's a lived reality for everybody, right? So when we're discussing this, then why we're saying that they need to be maybe vermin species is also, this evidence speaks to that a lot.
Yeah, even, I mean, I'm going slightly off track. I don't know if you guys saw this movie called Kantara recently, a Kannada movie. It became a super hit. In that, the main protagonist, goes on to hunt a wild boar. And it's very much part of their culture, their tradition, their festivals, you know, of living in harmony with the animal. But at the same time, during festival, there are many reasons why it does. And even in states, right, different states have different exceptions that they make, like the Jallikattu in Tamil Nadu, or, the Kodi Pandalu or cockfighting in Andhra, which are, of course, mainstream, because they're mostly by upper caste people, the state supports it. Here, the state government in Madhya Pradesh does it, help or try and figure out a way of making sure that the cultural and societal implications are not as much, I mean, does the government help in any way?
Do you mean in terms of, you know, offering some kinds of leeways to ensure that, you know, because like you said, hunting is also so intimately tied to, of course, not just people's livelihoods, but also their culture, that is safeguarded in some way? Is that what you're asking?
Yes, yes.
No, not that we... I mean, and also, there is an increasing push also to criminalize those cultures, right? To basically say that it is actually because of this way of living of these communities that animals or the existence of animals is endangered. So it's not only that there are steps that are being taken to safeguard that, it's also actively to, you know, contrast these ways of living with as being detrimental to the conservation of wildlife. And you're seeing that, for instance, say with fishing, and which is what your other question was, right?
Yeah.
Like the right to fishing, and you know, you see the state, like it's very interesting, this duality of the state, right? So the Forest Rights Act was passed in 2006, which is a right, which is a law which was after, you know, many years of struggle by forest dwelling communities. Yeah. It was said that their rights over the forest and forest land and resources must be recognized, that these guys have intergenerationally and traditionally had these rights. Yes. And now this law is recognizing this. We've seen one, of course, in largely in the way that this law has been received by those who are invested in wildlife conservation, to say that this is a law that is actually detrimental to that. So there have been several attempts that have been made to dilute this law, so much so that in 2019, the Supreme Court also delved into the constitutionality of the law in a case where certain wildlife organizations had approached the Supreme Court to relook certain provisions of the law and say, you know, they had basically said that there were people whose claims were pending or people whose claims had been rejected by the bodies under the Forest Rights Act, and that those people should be evicted. And the Supreme Court decided to take it a step further and took suo motu cognizance and said, okay, they want to delve into the constitutionality of the law. So, I mean, of course, that particular judgment didn't go through. I mean, it's still pending hearing because there were massive protests across the country. So you have this sort of larger picture where this law is being viewed that way. And then there are certain rights, for instance, like fishing, which are safeguarded under this law. And now you are seeing that people are being criminalized and being charged by the Forest Department for fishing.
Mm.
So there are certain species, for instance, and this is what our research reveals, that of course there are certain species of fish that are protected by the law. But when you do an analysis of this data, you see that people are being criminalized for fishing in toto.
Mm.
Not just for fishing of certain kinds of species.
Like, how do you, I mean, when you are fishing, you don't know if you are fishing a protected fish or not. Exactly. Protected fish, right?
Yeah.
I mean, as is like, because they're fishing in a protected area, is this a case or how does it work?
So, yes, it is fishing in a protected area that's being seen as a criminal offense. But I will say, Rakesh, how we know that these are not about protected species of fish is because the Forest Department, one, records which schedule an animal that has been hunted falls under, and the records that we've accessed show that this was under Schedule 5, which is technically supposed to speak to vermin species, which are not supposed to be criminalized at all. And when you look at what it is they are criminalizing, they don't actually use hunting provisions all the time. What they use instead is very, very vague provisions under the Wildlife Protection Act, which say entry, any activity in a protected area. Any, you can, the power that's there for search, seizure, all of, and to assume that a criminal act has been committed are also so overreaching, and they're so expansive that there's very little questioning that happens. So in effect, what we're seeing is routinely this happening. And so something as little as like half a kg, 250 grams of fish that becomes a criminal case that goes on for years together. One of the cases we also analyzed shows that showed us that one accused person had also won a batch of 4 or 5 people who were caught for fishing were arrested and, of course, subject to a lot of custodial violence by the range officer and the forest department, the forest guards. But one of the accused persons also now passed away since the prosecution was initiated and all of this has happened, and the case is still pending. So it's not merely that there is any mechanism within the forest department that's being activated where you can tell, okay, that this is not a case that needs to go forward, or even once it reaches court that that case is being thrown out. It's that you know ultimately that you might get an acquittal because the case is ultimately baseless, but it's still that these prosecutions are ongoing and that there's no stoppage anywhere there in questioning why these sections, how, what exactly act. That's being said, and the idea when we spoke to Forest Department officials about why this is something that should be, why this is something they're criminalizing, is and these ideas very much vary. It's about, oh, they are disturbing the ecological security, and you know they it's their intent. We know that they want to disturb the park, or it can be something. Or the other thing that we were told was that they can't take the fish because the fish is for other animals to eat, and that's how they are disturbing the park. Which you see that none of this is actually there in the letter of the law, and all of this is very much coming in from like how you see forest rights and where you see rights accruing versus where those boundaries are made, and because it's also the Forest Department which plays a part in how forest, what the Gram Sabha says when it comes to forest rights, what area they are allowed to use versus what rights they can use. All of that is mediated through the Forest Department.
You talk specifically in the report about how there are no narratives in the FIR, and most times, you know, anonymous sources or, like you said, Mukbis,
informants.
Yes. Are the ones mentioned in the report. So there is no, and also about the location, like there is never clear mention about the location of the offense for people to revisit or, you know, check and do anything, right? To check if it is truth or not. Can you talk a little bit about it? I thought it's interesting that there is no narrative in the FIR, and how do, I mean, if a case goes on for 16 years, how are they revisited, and how can anyone take any action or, you know, or squash the case or anything for that?
No, matter? Which is why they are, I mean, because like they're so vague in the way in which they describe these offenses, right? Like you said, I mean, you pointed out that most of these, and this is a very common policing practice, something that we have seen across, you know, various kinds of offenses, that every time you see, you know, this is not unique to the Forest Department, every time you see an FIR or, you know, and we see this happening even with the Forest Department. If you see, okay, what is the source of information? How has this particular investigating body found out that this offense has taken place? The source, more often than not, is a Mukbir. And a Mukbir is this anonymous figure, because the idea is that, you know, they are, you know, their identity is required to be kept anonymous. So you don't know who these people are, but it is like information and tip-offs from them that is, you know, triggering this offense. And then, again, you know, when you read FIRs, and this is like you're seeing in the case of this, you're seeing that there is, of course, there are all of these vague descriptions about the site of the offense. There are practically, like, you don't have enough information. There are no, you know, procedures that are followed, say, in terms of seizures. You know, you're, like, for instance, under the Wildlife Protection Act, and it's a very unique kind of power that the Forest Department has under this law, which the police also doesn't have, which is that all confessions that an accused person makes in custody are admissible in evidence. Which is not the case when it comes to the police, right? Because there is a recognition of the fact that people can be coerced into admitting. But there is a procedure that is to be followed in terms of how that confession is recorded and who signs off on it. You will see more often than not, you will see that an accused person has confessed, allegedly confessed to committing a crime. But you will see that, like a, and Mrinalini, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that somebody who's higher in position than a range officer needs to sign off on this, right?
Exactly. The rank of an SDO. Yeah.
Rank of an SDO, but you will almost never see, like somebody of that designation, you will at best see a range officer signing off on it. So you will see that there are all of these procedural lapses, and then the cases are pending for, like you said, leading up to 16 years, and then they fall apart. But what it also means is that even though you've been acquitted by a court, it also means that the moment you've been charged for one offense, and this is also a very common policing practice, it makes you susceptible to being implicated in more offenses. So it also means that then the narrative of you're a habitual offender comes to be built. And your criminal record is built. Like, we have seen during our field visits that there are like habitual offender records. So they have these history sheets, these registers that they maintain in police stations. And the forest department maintains it in their range offices. You're seeing that people's records are being maintained even after they've passed away, or their records are maintained over the years even when they've been acquitted for offenses. So it's a vicious cycle, right? Once you've gotten a foot into the system, there is no way that you're going to come out of it.
Yeah, I mean, you also talk about in your research about the oppressed caste predominantly being targeted by using these. Can you talk a little bit more about how what your research says about that?
That I just want to add one thing. This is, sorry, I'm backtracking a
bit. No problem, please.
But about protected areas, like, I just want to say that it is appalling that there is a sort of legal sanction for a place for this kind of inviolate space to exist, where mere entry into that space is itself criminalized. And we have spoken to several forest department officials to ask them, they understand it in terms of core and buffer. So core is where entry into the core area, and these are all comprised of various protected areas, is an offense by law. And you ask them, but how do you demarcate, right? How do you know which is your core area? Mm-hmm. So it is this nebulous category that exists. For which there is legal sanction, but it is ultimately, in terms of physical space, it's very hard for people, or even in terms of defining it in the law, there exists no definition. But entry into that area is an offense. Like, we met this one person we've met several people who have been charged for entering protected areas, but we met this one person who was, and him and three other people have been, like, their case has been pending in court for 16 years because they've entered a protected area to get 200 grams of honey. And now one of the co-accused has died, but the case continues to remain pending. So you're seeing that this sort of, like, and this obviously goes back to your question about oppressed caste, right? Like, it's very interesting how, it's almost like if you look at the rationale of caste also, the rationale of caste says that there are certain places that are out of bounds for people belonging to certain caste groups, right? The so-called lower caste groups. You're seeing a replication of this kind of, rationale even in the law, where the mere existence of people belonging to certain groups is by itself a violation in certain spaces. Right? Like, a lower caste person walking into a Brahmin's house is a violation, right? Even if they do something or don't do something, just the fact that there are certain norms that should not be transgressed of, caste-based mingling that have been violated. Like, here you're seeing just people crossing a certain threshold, or, for, like, the mainstream audience, if you would understand the, obviously, given the their favorite Ramayana, if you understand what is the Lakshman Rekha, just people crossing into that threshold is considered to be a violation. Similarly, you're seeing that happening with forest-dwelling communities in protected areas.
And it's very much that narrative of pollution that's continuing in, right? Because you're polluting a pristine environment, which is for the very, very noble aim of, like, conservation. And that's the idea of conservation that's there. It's based on purity.
No, that's a very interesting analogy. I never thought of it that way. about, you know, how we are just replicating the same old systems.
But I will come to the number, like the in terms of like numbers, what we're seeing in a while we've laid out that, yeah, there are ways of being that are obviously criminalized by this creation of a protected area, or what kind of activity happens there, and it's in REM, anything. And but when we speak in terms of numbers, where when we look at the FIRs that were registered in terms of hunting, we see that over 63% of the FIRs that we studied, it comprised of persons from like scheduled caste, scheduled tribe, denotified tribal, and OBC, and other oppressed communities that we're able to confirm of. And when it comes to the Forest Department, the number is much higher, and it becomes close to 78% of the accused persons who belong to like these oppressed caste communities. And while it might seem very natural to say that, oh, forest dwelling communities primarily consist of scheduled tribes, so therefore they might be the ones that are accused. What's very important, there are two things that are important for us to see. We've also checked the over-representation that's there in each of these districts where you can tell what the population is. And in terms of the police data, we can see that there is over-representation at least seven of the 33 districts where arrests are being carried out. And when it comes to the Forest Department, it's much higher. I think it's about 14 of the 27 areas where we studied, there was over-representation in terms of like what population these communities form and in what gradation they're being arrested. So we do see that over-representation very, very much. And the second thing is that where this grand narrative of poaching exists, and that's something I wanted to reflect on even earlier, that one, when we look at what animal is being hunted, we can very clearly see that this is not about animals that are being poached, right? This is actually about animals which are everyday occurrences and people interact with on a daily basis that is being criminalized. And the second thing is that even as we know of, when we've interviewed people that work with wildlife conservation NGOs, we've seen that the way poaching rings also work is that you have somebody from the community, obviously, who's going into the forest, and the people that also get criminalized even in that situation are not these international crime rings, any of those people that are being criminalized. But even in those situations, it is very much people from the community, the lowest form of the ring, and they don't go up. Like, that's where they show their arrests and the heft of their success in conservation. It's still being carried out amongst the same people.
Yeah, no, I was also thinking about the same. I mean, if poaching is the main reason why they are filing FIRs, then all these animals are not necessarily, you know, like you said, you know, parrots or peacocks. These are not necessarily the animals that are being poached. So is it really solving the purpose is the question. Yeah. Anything else that you guys want to add? I think I covered a lot of questions that I had.
I just want to add one thing about the Mugbirs,
yes,
and this is also a common pattern. I mean, and with the Forest Department and across, methods of policing, is that the Mugbirs more often than not are from the communities that are being criminalized. So the history of that is initially they used to recruit Mugbirs from the oppressor caste communities, because the idea was that, of course, these communities are not trustworthy. But then they realized the value of recruiting Mugbirs from these communities, because then they thought that it's also a great way to, you know, obviously divide and rule, right? So you create that sort of tension, suspicion within the community. And a lot of people are being paid a paltry sum of money by the Forest Department to do Mugbiri. And also because, you know, so much of it is shrouded in secrecy, it is creating a lot of these intra-community dynamics where there is violence within the community because, you know, one person suspects another of having told on, you know, for telling on them to the Forest Department. So you're also seeing all of this, like, people belonging to these communities being pushed into these systems as a way of, you know, negotiating with the department for their survival, and then of course again, you know, facing the wrath of their own community members. So we're seeing that also happen. And Mrinalini, I think it would be useful for you to speak about compounding and how, like, the forest, like, wildlife cases have one of the longest, highest rates of both pending in court.
Yeah, that I mean, I do want to come to this, because especially because we've had an amendment bill that was deliberated quite a bit. It went to a parliamentary standing committee. So in terms of engagement, we've seen maybe more engagement than otherwise with many bills in the recent past that's been, that's been made into law now. And what is it? I want to talk a little bit about what is it that we are now bolstering through this amendment. And what we've done is, while we've covered an additional amount of species to be protected, and none of these are naturally occurring species as such, this is more to prohibit international trade. But the other thing which has happened is that we've also bolstered the penalties and the fines. So in where the fine was 10,000 earlier, it's now been made 25,000. But where the fine pertains to, where it was earlier 25,000 rupees, and this was for offences in a protected area, it's now been bolstered by 4 times to make it 1 lakh. And this is something that we've not seen any engagement with. And what is the system that we are bolstering by increasing the penalties? And apart from, like, the findings that we've spoken about, especially when we see that the Forest Department, which has expansive powers of policing, which is rarely questioned, and there are the kind of checks and balances we might see even possible with the police in a limited way, are not there with the Forest Department, because it is an opaque department very much. Yeah, and one, given that they have really expansive powers, and second, that the way in which we're seeing criminalization occur, there are a few things which are particularly concerning. When the Forest Department prosecutes the bulk of offences under this Act, the question that arises also in their policing is that how much are they complying with what they need to be recording, right? Even in terms of the basic amounts of policing that we see, where recoveries are reported, like, what seizure are you making? We see that in over 50% of the cases, there are no recoveries that are reported by the Forest Department. There's no confirmation on the method of hunting. In an FIR, you at least have the narrative that comes in, but the Forest Department is not required to furnish this anywhere in their records until they go to court to file this in front of a magistrate. So this is one concerning thing, and the burden of proof under this Act, of course, is very much in favor of the Forest Department. So once you have the confession of the accused person, which, as Nikita said, is completely valid in law, and the second thing, you have an animal where you don't have to disclose how this animal was hunted and what meat the animal might resemble at. You don't need to do this until the trial. The burden of proof is already working against accused persons. And even within the law, there are 2-3 safeguards that might be there. One, that bail is supposed to be given, yet in none of the cases that we saw, bail was given at the station or at the instance of when the arrest occurred. That is something we've not seen across anywhere at all. And the second thing being, where there's a possibility to compound cases that that are of less serious in nature, right? Now, it's an entirely different thing that all offences that happen in relation to hunting in a protected area are considered grave. But here again, the importance of what is a core, what is a buffer becomes very important, because a buffer in common parlance is not considered a very big part of the protected area. But what it does in law is that it automatically allows the Forest Department to say that this is not a case we will compound. And by compounding, I mean that this is a case that can be decided out of court with just a payment of a small fine. And there is no need for the entire adjudication of a trial process that needs to happen. Yes, we've seen in over the 1400 cases that are there, across whatever animals were hunted and where they were hunted, not just in protected areas alone, what we've seen is that in only 13%, not even 13, sorry, actually in 4% of the cases, what we've seen, has there been compounding possible. And this is also backed up by for interviews we've done with the officials, where they very clearly said, no, these are issues where we do not want to compound at all as a matter of practice, regardless of the fact that this option exists in law. But because they want to continue this fear of the protected area, of the department that already exists, and they want to, and they think that this plays a role in deterrence. They choose not to compound these cases at all. And I think this is very, very telling of the system we are bolstering through an amendment that we are constantly saying that no, there needs to be more policing. What is it? What kind of policing and who is doing that policing, I think, is a question that that we've tried to answer through our research.
So what do you guys, in the report you spoke about in detail about the problems, but what do you guys think are, you know, feasible solutions or what has to change for things to fall in place? That what do you guys have any thoughts on that?
I think, through the Forest Rights Act and for Schedule 5 areas through PESA, which is the Panchayat Extension to Scheduled Areas Act, there's already an imagination that was set into motion of thinking about a form of forest governance and conservation that is centered in the experiences and led by forest dwelling communities, right? And I think what we are seeing now is that that imagination in the 90s was put into motion, but that being completely overshadowed by this criminal legal framework through laws like the Wildlife Conservation Act, Wildlife Protection Act, which are basically like bolstering, you know, what we've been talking about, these Brahminical ideas of conservation and, you know, seeing the existence of these communities and their ways of being as being antithetical to conservation, right? So I think, first, I think, like, very fundamentally, there needs to be, which there hasn't been so far, is reckoning of the fact that environmentalism and ideas of conservation in India are Brahminical in nature, and that the biggest sort of weapon of implementing that has been criminal law. So how can you make sure that these are laws that are being, like, the if, like, the extent of those laws is being curtailed, and that they are, like, the other ways of being through, you know, the forest rights, etc., those are laws that are being implemented in their spirit. Like, for instance, with the Wildlife Protection Act, like, steps that are being taken, like we need to think of, you know, what can be ways of decriminalizing the hunting of certain kinds of species, right? Or even thinking of what might be ways of, if you think that something has been there is a harm that has been caused to an animal or to the forest, what might be non-criminal legal ways of addressing that? I think that is something that really needs to be thought about.
Thank you for listening to this episode. You can now listen to all our episodes on our Android and iPhone app. Download it now.